Diolch yn fawr iawn, a diolch i'r Unedd Cymru am y gwahoddiad I siarad heno. I'm very grateful for the opportunity of speaking this evening. And I've been given one thought already by Tessa in her remarks about the possible futures of this project. She mentioned Anna Karenina. Now, I owe to Di Smith, present here this evening, the remark made by Gwynalf Williams that given the patterns of industrial export in the 19th century, probably the last words that Anna Karenina read before the train rolled over her were "made in Dalwais." So if you wished to extend Welsh literary tours to St. Petersburg, I'm sure that would be very welcome to many people. My mother's father was a bookbinder, among other things. He also ran a butcher's business in Ystradgynnais. But as a keen bookbinder, he would gather together all sorts of unlikely and unexpected books which had come his way. Not all of them seemed to find their way back to their original owners. So when I was a child, there were always unexpected books lying around the place, waiting to be bound. And one of those unexpected books was a pocket edition of Charlotte Guest's translation of the Mabinogion. And I suppose I must have been about 8 when I began to work my way laboriously through these complex stories in rather unrewarding Victorian typeface. The Mabinogion is full of stories which could be called a fusion of Clare and Llenyddiaeth. They are about place in a very particular way. Look at the catalogues of names that you find. Look at the importance of location at the very beginning, Peracaic. But look also at the extraordinary literary tourism implied in Cilwch ac Olwen, where you have a rather bewildering tour of sites all around South and West Wales, the location of which is extremely obscure, even to the most expert of scholars in the field. But it's a reminder that early literature of that kind is deeply invested in place. Stories are not told in midair. Stories are told to explain why places are the way they are, why place names are as they are, and somehow to invite you to read a landscape in terms of its human history, of conflict, of sorcery, of romance. A reminder that landscape itself never just sits there for the human eye and the human mind. Landscape is always more than it seems, and it waits for words to bring it alive again and again. Imaginative art, whether poetry, fiction, or the visual arts, or whatever, imaginative art always tunes into that something more, that unexpressed and unexplored residue in the world around us. Imaginative art says that our relation to the world around is not passive, that the landscapes given us, the landscapes of thought and story and literally of place, are there so that we may recreate. I won't give you the excursus on theology at this point, though it cries out to be made, but I will simply say that this declares something so important about the nature of our humanity that we lose sight of it at our peril and our cost. We need to understand ourselves. More and more we need to understand ourselves in a shrinking, oppressive cultural environment. To understand ourselves as people whose relation to our environment, material, political, social, imaginative, is not passive. We are engaging with and wrestling with what is given. We are drawing out of it more than seems to be there. We are making it new. And that is perhaps why we are so fascinated by the literary landscape. We go to a place, a setting, where we begin to get some sense of how one mind and heart and imagination reacted to the invisible, the extra, and perhaps our own sense of the invisible and the extra is kindled at that moment. Well, the Mabinogion lasted me quite a while, and indeed is still something I return to with delight. But in secondary school, I'm sorry, there's going to be quite a lot of school reminiscence in all this. In secondary school, of course, other things began to happen. We started learning Welsh. That is to say, we started learning proper Welsh. We learned that the Welsh we had learned from our parents was ungrammatical and unsatisfactory. And it's a shame, really, looking back on the teaching of Welsh in those days, that that was the first impression many of us had who came from homes in which Welsh was spoken, that the Welsh of our parents and our families was somehow second rate. I think we've got beyond that in Wales today. But some of the tension and conflict between different kinds of Welsh is one of the themes that cries out for more exploration and more reflection, I think, as we look at our recent history, especially in the post-war period. That's another story. But although my fluency then and now in Welsh is pretty faulty, I began to learn to spell my way through some of the more recent literature of Wales, and as the years went on, discovered more and more landscapes of the imagination opening up there. But one particular landscape, which has not much to do with the language, but to do with the history, opened up very, very differently when we had a history teacher at school who suggested that for our O-level history, and more for our O-level history than for our O-level English, it has to be said, we should start reading some novels about Welsh industrial history. My friends and I worked our way through Alexander Cordell and Richard Llewellyn with more of a sense of duty than enjoyment sometimes, but with an enhanced sense there of place and history as something that did not belong in a remote literary context, but was the flesh and blood of what we were actually learning about in note form in our history lessons. That the people we were learning about in history lessons were individuals with relationships, with tragedies, with joys. It's all too easy to look back on those novels of industrial life with a degree of superiority and skepticism, and of the film version of How Green Was My Valley, I can only quote what I think Queen Elizabeth said to a disobedient lady-in-waiting at some point around 1590, "God may forgive you, but I never shall." But it meant that when my aspiring literary friends and I were in the sixth form, one of the things we attempted to do in a not completely serious spirit was to draft an outline for the great Welsh novel. We felt that after years of exposure to Richard Llewellyn and Alexander Cordell, we could do this standing on our heads. And I recently rediscovered my sixth form notebook, which contains, for future literary historians, an outline of the great Welsh novel to end all great Welsh novels, corporately drafted by myself and three friends in the lower sixth of Dinevor in Swansea in 1967. I'm considering to whom I should leave this unique literary treasure, and I'm willing at the end of this evening to receive any bids that anyone would like to make for this remarkable document. Easy, as I say, to look down on it, easy to parody it. And yet, it is one of the ways for us to enter into the humanity of our own Welsh history. And that's one reason why I don't despise it entirely. But it was probably in that same sixth form period that I, and again some of my friends, began to become seriously aware of the Anglo-Welsh poetic tradition. R.S. Thomas was already, of course, on the O-level syllabus for some people, even in the 1960s. But with the publication of Welsh Voices, I think 1967, and The Lilting Planet, that began to come into focus a little more clearly for us. Other voices entered the scene. My first exposure to the work of David Jones was through some of those collections of Anglo-Welsh verse at that time. And I seem to remember there was a promising youngish poet by the name of Gillian Clark, whose name first came across my horizon around that time also. And that particular wandering star has continued to shine with greater and greater brilliance in the firmament. And I'm very happy to pay that tribute tonight, Gillian. But those voices were, of course, if you were at school in Swansea, somewhat drowned out by the great local voice of Dylan Thomas. And like every aspiring adolescent poet in Swansea at the time, I began to produce reams of second-rate imitations of Dylan Thomas. Some of those, again, still exist, I'm afraid, not in manuscript form, but in printed form in the school magazine. And in this particular context, I am willing to offer large sums to buy up any surviving copies of those. But we were also aware, and I remember being told about this by our English teacher at the time, of another Swansea poet, the one I've myself dubbed Swansea's other poet, Vernon Watkins. We were told about his death at that time, I remember, and I began to read some of his work and get a sense of the enormous variety of Welsh literatures. And I'm very glad indeed that the title offered me tonight was Welsh Literatures, because, of course, I have already talked about a variety of literatures, a particular kind of semi-populist prose fiction, an archaic tradition of prose romance, a tradition of English language writing, various traditions of Welsh language writing. And around that same time, of course, the Penguin Book of Welsh Verse was published. And for me, and I guess for others, that was yet another doorway into unexpected riches. And what I began to understand, wrestling with the Penguin Book and with some of the originals, and I could decipher them, what I began to understand was something about poetry itself, not simply what I referred to earlier about the way in which poetry, like the other arts, draws out what is invisible in an environment, but something also about the way in which poetry, exceptionally and unusually, but not in total discontinuity with the other arts, poetry deliberately turns up the tension in language in order to bring certain things to light. Poetry tightens the screws of language. It quite literally tightens the stress of language. That's to say, it works with the patterns of stress and slack, the in-breathing and out-breathing of speech. It sharpens those up so as to bring contours out from language itself that you hadn't suspected. And it was the introductory essay to that same Penguin Book of Welsh Verse that spelled out in accessible ways just how that worked in the classical traditions of Welsh poetry. How by submitting yourself to an exceptionally sophisticated and prohibitively difficult discipline, you forced language, you might almost say, to deliver up some of its secrets. You drew out, again, what was invisible and unsuspected. Just as in a literal landscape, so with words themselves, the requirements of assonance and rhyme draw out something of the meanings of words that you never suspected. Once again, it's about language being an intensely active, an intensely generative matter, not just flat description not just semi-passive response. When I went on to graduate study at Oxford after reading theology at Cambridge, I had a very pleasant surprise in finding that my doctoral supervisor, the late Donald Altshin, known to many here, I think, was an enthusiast for the Welsh literary tradition. On one of the first occasions I met him to have a supervision about 20th century Russian religious thought, he sat me down and made me read aloud to him from Eiros Bowen. And it was Donald who introduced me to Eiros Bowen a year or two later for a conversation that I shall long remember. So I was once again brought back to an engagement with a particular kind of poetic tradition. And in the years that followed, that continued to draw me back with a high degree of enthusiasm, an engagement, and sometimes a sense of being rather intimidated. It was about 25 years ago that, revisiting some of those poems I'd read in translation in the sixth form, I began to undertake the discipline of trying to translate. And it was indeed Walter Williams's Mwymdai Gai that was the first substantial Welsh poem I tried my hand at translating. And that discipline of translation has been for me for the last, I suppose, 20 years now, a very significant part of my own attempt to engage with the traditions that I inherit as a reader of Welsh literatures. Translation is particularly difficult when it is dealing with a literary genre or a set of literary genres so intensely technical, so intensely intricate and self-referential. There are things you cannot do with Welsh poetry in translation, and I found early on I had to stop trying to do them. But that doesn't absolve you from the effort to get inside the flow and the energy of a poem. And it was in translating Waldo, in the first instance, that I began to see ways of translating other poets in other languages. And such work as I've attempted in translating from German and from Russian in more recent years has had a lot to do with what I learned in that initial exercise. Don't look so much at how the poet is doing it. Try to attune yourself to the movement of metaphors if you want to translate, and you'll find your own how. The rhythm, or what the French Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain called the pulsions, are what you have to attend to. Not in any way that makes the particulars of the language and the technique dispensable or secondary, far from it. But if you're going to translate, you're going to be doing something completely different. And so you have to find what level it is that can actually be reshaped, rendered in another form. And I wrote some years ago a little essay on the experience of trying to translate Mwymdai Gai, an essay which I revisited recently and, of course, wanted to rewrite almost every sentence of, because the experience of translating goes on, requiring its own translation. You've been very, very patient in listening to my autobiographical ramblings, but I feel obliged to try and draw together the points that might be of substance and might be of interest for this wonderful project that we're involved in launching. And I have to say that it is a brilliant, imaginative venture to which I wish every possible success. And the important things seem to me to be about, in very basic primary school terms, learning to look and learning to listen. Learning to look. Sharing that experience of a place. Looking at what is there and trying to sense something of the drawing out of what isn't there or isn't yet there by the imagination. That's a real kindling of our own capacity, our own freedom. It's an ambitious way of talking about literary tourism. But if, I so put it, if literary tourism is to be more than just literary tourism, if it's actually to be something that is humanly important for people involved in it, that's the level at which it needs to work. Trying to get in touch with what it is that makes somebody's imagination grasp what is not yet there, and somehow mysteriously add to what is there by their own imaginative response. As I said earlier, that's not a luxury or some elitist kind of response to the arts. It's about rediscovering a credible political and social humanity at a time when different kinds of barbarism threaten us. But the second thing, as I hinted, is in that entry into the imagination, in that search for the pulsions, the energy in imaginative work, what we are doing for ourselves is turning up the tension a little bit. Responding to or pushing back a little bit against the slackness of habitual response. Understanding that difficulty is good for us. Again, not in a perversely elitist sense, not in a Mandarin way, but to understand that we have work to do with our imaginations, in our relationships, in our environment, in our society. Work to do, and the capacity and the gift to do it. The project that we're concerned about this evening is one which has enormous promise for the health of our society, not just for the entertainment of dedicated readers. I was really delighted to hear Feike underlining just how global, just how comprehensive the vision was, where we need to get all this vision, all this energy. And since, as Providence would have it, I was speaking only last night about Walter Williams, I can only echo with delight that particular reference to the fields full of folk that Waldo envisages in that key passage of the poem. And of course, to what emerges from that, Awen and Cordior Kiev, something arising from the hiddenness of people's lives that enlivens and inspirits. That Awen, arising from what's hidden, has been what I've constantly sensed, related to, in my own encounters with the literatures of Wales. And I'm delighted to think that those riches and those gifts will be so abundantly available to so many more people through this project, and I wish it well. Diolch yn fawr iawn.